I want to say a word about the need for discernment in our times. This has been a week of apologies, actually maybe a couple weeks of apologies. You may have noticed that. So we have a quarterback who apologized for saying, "Hey, I can't get behind someone disrespecting the flag." And he came back and apologized for that. And we had a TV personality who dared to say, "All lives matter." And then he apologized for saying that. We had a college that apologized to its students because they dared to let police officers use their bathrooms. The same police officers who defend the campus. And the students were hurt. They were traumatized by this. And the college apologized for that. We had a high-ranking U.S. general apologize for daring to be close enough to the United States president, to be close enough to be in a picture with him while dressed in military garb. We had a mayor of a major city come out and apologize because she had made a video thanking the local police for the work that they do. And all of these apologies just spilling out for offenses that are clearly worse than genocide. Do you wonder now what gives? What is going on? What's real anymore? And I think this underscores the need for discernment, and it underscores the problem with Christians just kind of jumping on this bandwagon because it's popular now. It's this cultural movement, and so let's get on board. You want to know if a cultural movement is from God, whether or not you should get on board? Well, I put together kind of a list of questions. I actually posted that on social media last night because I'm a little bit concerned about what I'm seeing. I think several questions would help us as we evaluate cultural movements and ask the question, to what extent do we want to get involved or should we get involved? Here are some questions. Do you see in this movement humility or pride? Do you see love or anger? Is the movement characterized by love? Is this about Jesus? Is this about God? Is that what it's about? Do you see wisdom or foolishness? Do you see orderliness or chaos? Is the movement based in truth? Is the emphasis on individual responsibility or is it on collective guilt? In other words, guilt by association. Is the emphasis, as Christians, we should care about this, is the emphasis on forgiveness or retribution and revenge? Before we get on a bandwagon, we need to ask, just remind ourselves, we are followers of Jesus Christ, okay? A follower of Jesus Christ doesn't follow the culture, at least not blindly. So if there's a popular cultural movement, ask how well that movement matches up with the Word of God. Is there an emphasis on the gospel? Is there a recognition of God as the authority? It is God's truth and God's values that are driving our activity. Is good understood in the context of grace? And is evil understood in the context of sin? Is Christ exalted as the solution? Is love, forgiveness, reconciliation, are those the goals? Are those the things that we're driving at? And not just what's going on right now, but I think any movement can be evaluated on the basis of some of these criteria. Does the whole thing just remind you a lot of Jesus? Okay? That's a good question. Does the whole thing make me think of Jesus' ministry? Okay? And if not, is it a counterfeit movement? We are called to follow, Christians. We're called to follow, but not cultural movements. We are called to lead the culture, and we lead the culture by leading them to the one we do follow. Okay? Our times require wisdom and discernment, not just blindly following along. And these are dark times, I think. If you're watching the news, I know some people have checked out of the news. I certainly understand that temptation. But these are dark moments, and I think it's going to get darker. But it's in the darkness that we bring out the lights, right? We don't go searching for the flashlight when the sun's shining. The lights come out in the darkness. And Jesus said, "You are the light of the world." So we have opportunity here to point people to Jesus. Quick story for you. And this is maybe a little bit at the risk of sounding like I'm like this is about me. It's not. It may be hard for some of you to believe. If you've been out to my house, there are actually spots in my yard that still don't have a tree planted there. And so to correct this problem, Kay and I went to a tree auction yesterday. And so they had kind of you've been to these auctions where they have a trailer and they have all these windows and you go up and you give them your information and then they, you know, give you a bidder's card. And so I was getting my bidder's card and the lady behind the window asked for my name and I said, "Sean Meyer." And there are three or four, you know, ladies there at these windows. And the one on the very end, her head snapped around and went, and she was helping a customer and she stopped and she said, "Are you the Sean Meyer that used to work at Camp Luther Haven?" Now, I worked at Camp Luther Haven 30 years ago. I was telling this story today. I think it was Tom said, "Was that a good thing or a bad thing that she remembered you?" If it was from high school, it was a bad thing. But this was after high school. And the Lord had gotten a hold of me, and I was serving the Lord through camp ministry, but I didn't recognize her. I didn't recognize her name, and she said, "I remember you," and I thought, "Oh, that's really weird." And so later, after we had bought our trees, I went out to get my truck, and I gave Kay the card, and she was going up to pay. And I brought the truck back, and then I saw that she had made her way up to the front. So I just went over there just to make sure I didn't get overcharged for anything. And she happened to be, you know, in line with this girl, this lady now. And we paid, and she said, and there was a line behind us. And she said, I'll make this fast, but I want you to know something. She said, "I want you to know that God used you in my life to draw me to Him." Wow. 30 years ago, maybe 28 or 29 years ago. I was oblivious to that. I just didn't recognize her. And it got me thinking, even when we don't know what we're doing, because at that age, I mean, I just had so much growing. I still do, but I was just immature in my faith. But I wanted to serve the Lord. And I wanted to tell the story of Jesus. And that, I cared a lot about that. And I'd forgotten about that. But yet, the work endured. And I don't know maybe what, you know, events that affected who she had influenced in her life. And I just want to encourage you, just keep serving in His kingdom. You don't have to know what you're doing. Just serve Him, love Him, tell the story, be a light. You won't even know. Probably most of it you won't ever know until you get to heaven. But you think you will regret serving Him then when you start to see all of the impact you've made? Let's be busy about kingdom work. Please turn to the book of 1 Kings. book of Kings opens up with the story of David just in decline. Physically, he can't stay warm, so they bring in Abishag as a concubine to attend to him. And it's apparent to everyone now that the days of the king are numbered. David's oldest remaining son, Adonijah, put himself forward and he said, "I'll be king." And he attempted to seize control of the throne. And of course, he had Joab and he had Abiathar, the priest, on his side. And Nathan and Bathsheba, alarmed by this, kind of cook up this plan to provoke David to intervene and appoint Solomon to the throne while there is still time. The plan succeeded, and Adonijah's supporters all deserted him and scattered. And then, fearing for his life, Adonijah grabbed hold of the horns of the altar, begged for mercy, and Solomon said, "You may live if you show yourself to be a worthy man." And now we come to the action-packed chapter 2 of 1 Kings. Here we go, verse 1. When the time drew near for David to die, he gave a charge to Solomon, his son. "I am about to go the way of all the earth," he said. "So be strong, show yourself a man, and observe what the Lord your God requires. Walk in his ways and keep his decrees and commands, his laws and requirements as written in the law of Moses, so that you may prosper in all you do and wherever you go, and that the Lord may keep his promise to me. If your descendants watch how they live and if they walk faithfully before me with all their heart and soul, you will never fail to have a man on the throne in Israel." In Psalm 119, David declares, "Oh, how I love your law. I meditate on it all day long." David had put the law to memory, because a lot of the language that we see here is right in this deathbed charge that he's giving Solomon. A lot of it is just straight out of the book of Deuteronomy. Like, same verbiage here. Deuteronomy, just a few examples. Deuteronomy 11, "Love the Lord your God and keep his requirements, his decrees, his laws and commands always. Observe the commands of the Lord your God," Deuteronomy 8. "Walking in his ways and revering him." Deuteronomy 29, "Carefully follow the terms of this covenant so that you may prosper in everything you do." And you can find several other scriptures in Deuteronomy that sound so much like this charge that David is giving his son. Friends, like David, you will one day go the way of all the earth. I wonder if we think about that enough. That's a reference to death, by the way, going the way of all the earth. Nobody escapes it. What are you going to care about? What are you going to care about in your final moments? Okay, supposing you have children, and if you're fortunate enough to have some warning, you probably won't say to them, "Hey, you know, I worked hard on this lawn. Make sure you spray for dandelions each fall." Can you imagine saying that on your deathbed? Or can you imagine saying, "Remember, child, we're a Buckeyes family. Keep rooting for the Buckeyes." Jerry's over there. "Yeah, maybe." A godly person, when he is about to lay his head down for the last time, wants to know that his children and his children's children and his nieces and nephews and everyone within his realm of influence is going to follow the Lord carefully when he or she is no longer there to influence them. That's the chief concern, and it was for David here. And David had an additional incentive here. a lasting dynasty. But I'm not sure he got this right. David seems to have understood God's promise to him conditionally. In other words, your kingdom will endure if you do these steps. But when we go to 2 Samuel 7, it appears to be an unconditional promise that God gave to David. He says, "Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever." And I don't see an if. The fact is, because of God's character and God's truthfulness, Solomon and his descendants couldn't jeopardize the fulfillment of God's promise to David, even if they had wanted to. The promise that the kingdom would be established forever. And you're going to see that same faithfulness of God on display throughout this study. Now, moving forward from this point, from David's reign, moving on, verses 3 and 4 are kind of going to be the basis by which 1 and 2 Kings evaluates all the kings, both good and bad, both Israel and Judah, over the course of the centuries, not just King Solomon. What did these men do with their power, with their influence? Did they keep the commands of God? Were they faithful to the covenant? Did they walk faithfully before God with all their heart and with all their soul? David isn't done with his address to Solomon, although I think he might have done well just to stop right there at the end of verse 4. Because verses 2 and 4 that we just looked at, and the verses coming up, 5 to 9, seem like they could have come from two very different people with two very different sets of values. You'll see what I mean. Verse 5, this is all from the lips of David. "Now you yourself know what Joab, son of Zeruiah, did to me." Still talking to Solomon, still on his deathbed. "What he did to the two commanders of Israel's armies, Abner, son of Ner, and Amasa, son of Jether. He killed them, shedding their blood in peacetime as if in battle, and with that blood stained the belt around his waist and the sandals on his feet. Deal with him according to your wisdom, but do not let his gray head go down to the grave in peace." 1 Chronicles tells us that Joab was actually David's nephew, the son of Zeruiah, his sister. Joab was intensely loyal to David, though he did things his own way. He killed Absalom against David's orders, but out of that intense loyalty to David. And as noted, he also murdered Abner and Amasa. And it occurred to me this week, it's like they all start with A. I think if I was close to Joab, I'd just change my name if it started with an A. So he knocked off Absalom, Abner, and Amasa, all against David's wishes. And I think it's possible that, at least in Amasa's case, certainly in Absalom's, in Amasa's case, he may have been trying to protect the kingdom. Just as likely, he was trying to protect himself and his career ambitions. But his killing of Abner, if you remember that story, that was just pure revenge, okay? And Joab was ruthless, absolutely ruthless. But it was almost always in service of David's kingdom. Now, we might say that David rewards all of that loyalty now with betrayal by instructing Solomon to deal ruthlessly with him. Why is that? Some think that David, there was this concept of blood guilt, and that David was trying to purge his kingdom of the guilt associated with those murders. That's possible. It's also mentioned. So I think that's it's mentioned in narrative. So it's, I think that's very possible. Others think that David was worried that maybe Joab's initial allegiance to Adonijah. You remember that? Joab got on board with Adonijah and maybe David is thinking, okay, I know Joab. He's ruthless. He's conniving. He's crafty. And as soon as I'm gone, you know, this could mean the assassination of Solomon. Another strong possibility. But in any case, just think about it this way. In any case, David, on his deathbed, is ordering the assassination of his nephew, Solomon's cousin. And I don't think that seems worthy to be included in the last wishes. The second charge concerning his survivors is a refreshing change from the first. Verse 7, but show kindness to the sons of Barzillai of Gilead, and let them be among those who eat at your table. They stood by me when I fled from your brother Absalom. Barzillai was an old man, 80 years old, when he took care of David and his men when they were fleeing from Absalom. And so by this time, surely gone, probably long gone. And David wanted to ensure that the mutual love between these fathers extended to the generation of their sons. And I think there's something kind of touching about that. But those warm fuzzies are going to go away here. No sooner than he says that. Here come the final set of instructions. Verse 8. And remember, you have with you Shimei, son of Gera, the Benjamite from Bahurim, who called down bitter curses on me the day I went to Mahanaim. When he came down to meet me at the Jordan, I swore to him, by the Lord, I will not put you to death by the sword. But now, do not consider him innocent. You are a man of wisdom. You will know what to do to him. Bring his gray head down to the grave in blood. And you probably recall the story of Shimei. When David was fleeing from Jerusalem, Shimei was the one that was on the road. There's some artwork that I think we've actually used before that just depicts Shimei. He's pelting David and his men with rocks, and he's bringing down curses on them. And so that's when David is on his way out, okay? But shortly later, with Absalom dead and under a pile of rocks in the forest, David is making his victorious return trip to Jerusalem. And Shimei once again met him along the road, this time singing a very different tune. He humbled himself and begged David not to kill him. This is 2 Samuel 19. And David replied mercifully. Even though his men wanted Shimei to be executed on the spot, David promised him on oath, and I'm going to quote David here from 2 Samuel 19. He promised him on oath, you shall not die. But notice something subtle in our text this morning. When David retells this story to Solomon now, years later, he seems to tweak it just a bit, change it just a little bit, and a little bit is all it took. He tells Solomon, I swore to him by the Lord, I will not put you to death by the sword. Now, according to the 2 Samuel account, David didn't say, I won't do it. He just said, you shall not die. When you say, I won't do it, kind of leaves open the possibility that you could have someone else do it for you, doesn't it? Once again, I think it's possible. Maybe likely David's just looking out for the kingdom. Okay, here's my young son. I know Shimei. I know what he's like. I could handle him, but I don't know. Better bring his gray head down to the grave in blood. I think this is a stain on David's record. I have to wonder if in God's eyes, having Solomon do his dirty work no more absolved David from the death of Shimei than having the Ammonites kill Uriah. You know? Didn't Nathan the prophet say, you killed Uriah with the sword? David was 100 miles away. I don't know. It just seems like a stain. You're a man of wisdom. You'll know what to do to him. Let me translate that for you. Kill him, but be smart about it. And that's exactly what Solomon will do. And some would, and I've read good Old Testament scholars that I think I disagree with them, but they would say this was a practical necessity, that, you know, he had to kill him because he had to ensure the kingdom. Is that so? That you have to knock people off that you pledged you would live? That God's promise relies upon me knocking off my enemies? Doesn't this boil down to a lack of trust on David's part? What happened to the old David? The David who was at his best. I think David was at his best when he and Abishai stood over a sleeping King Saul. Do you remember that story? They stood over him. Abishai was the brother of Joab. And Abishai's like, oh man, let me. I'll drive the spear through him. I think he said, I won't even have to strike him twice. Just let me, one time. What did David say? Nope. He's the Lord's anointed. Even though in that moment, what was Saul doing? He was leading out a campaign, a military campaign to kill David. But David trusted that God would fulfill his promise to put him on the throne. It didn't require David helping him by plunging a spear into Saul's heart. When was David at his best? When he was trusting. When was David at his best? I think it was when he was returning from this battle with Absalom, and he's coming back toward Jerusalem. He's getting ready to cross the Jordan, and there's Shimei again. I think that was a true foreshadowing of Christ. Just as Christ on the road to Golgotha suffered insults and beatings, David had quietly endured the persecution he faced. Just as Christ told Peter, when Peter struck Malchus and cut his ear off, and Jesus said, put away your sword. What did David say when Abishai said, why should this dead dog curse the king? Let me go over and cut his head off. And David said, no. Just as Christ prayed for his enemies, Father, forgive them, David later told Abishai again, no one should be put to death in Israel today, forgiving Shimei, his enemy. Abishai was just itching for revenge. And David said, what do you and I have in common? You sons of Zariah, what do you and I have in common? Well, years later now, he answers his own question on his deathbed when he reneges on the promise and he instructs Solomon, bring his gray head down to the grave in blood. David at his Christ-like best has now become David one final time at his worst. Now, can you relate to that? I'm not talking about, have you ever asked someone to assassinate someone else, okay? I trust that that's probably not the case, although if it was, God could forgive you for that. But can you relate to that? Have you ever forgiven someone, just as David forgave Shimei, only to take it back, only to renege on your Christ-likeness? You ever pardoned someone and then later wished that you hadn't? I wonder how many times David, through the years, isn't this such a human thing? I wonder how many times through the years David just replayed the tape in his head. Shimei up there, pelting me and my officers with rocks, cursing me. I was humiliated. I was embarrassed. I wonder how many times he replayed the tape. And his pride nudging him, saying, you know, I was too easy on him. What was I thinking? I've done this. I've forgiven people of some pretty bad stuff. Stuff that, like, I'm kind of amazed. Like, wow, I didn't know that I could forgive somebody for something like that. And of course, it's always through the Lord. I've never done that in my own strength. But I've forgiven people. Only later to regret it. It felt so good at the time to forgive. But then the tape starts to replay. And maybe not right away, but after the 14th time that tape replayed in my head, I renege. It's like I became a different person than the one who canceled the offense. Can you relate to that? Can you relate to me and to David? I want to give you some advice. I think about this story of when this father came to Jesus. You remember when the father came to Jesus and said, I've got this son. He's demon-possessed. The demon, he foams at the mouth. The demon throws him on the ground, throws him in the water, throws him in the fire, tries to kill him. He's just, you know, and I took him to your disciples. They couldn't do anything. So Jesus cast the demon out of the man, or out of the boy. And later the disciples say, how'd you do it? Well, how come we couldn't do it? Because they had cast demons out of people. Why couldn't we do it? And Jesus said, this kind only comes out with prayer. I think bitterness is one of those things. Unforgiveness is one of those things. It's so human. And I'm talking about our fallen condition. It's just so like us to fail to completely pardon. It's so like us to hold on. I don't know about you, but for me, it's like that bitterness just, like it just sinks its hooks into my internal organs. And it only comes out with prayer. It only comes out, that is to say, by a work of God. You're not going to do it on your own. But you do have a responsibility. If God is going to help you to completely forgive and forget, you can't dwell on the past. You can't replay the tape. I think there is a lot to be said about spiritual forgetfulness. I think we want to forget about several things. First of all, I think we want to forget about the good things we've done for others because we don't want to hold people in debt. Okay? But I also think that we need to pray, God, let me forgive completely, wipe out. Gone from my memory, the offenses that others have committed against me. David didn't do that. David, at his Christ-like best, returned to David at his worst. Sometimes, folks, I don't know what it is for you, but sometimes, for me, if a memory starts, I like what Martin Luther said about this. I don't quote Martin Luther a lot, but Martin Luther said you can't keep a bird from flying over your head, but you can keep it from making a nest in your hair. Okay? It's true. Thoughts are going to come into your head that you're not proud of. And you'll go, where did that even come from? You'll just be sitting there one day and you'll be thinking about this sin, this offense that somebody committed against you. And you have a responsibility at that moment. You don't dwell on that. You pray. Sometimes I'll say it out loud. I don't do it when people are around because you look weird. But if I'm driving along down the road and I start to think about that thought, I'll say no. That was forgiven. That's gone. Just as Jesus forgave and forgot, Lord, help me to forgive and forget. Verse 10. Then David rested with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. He had reigned 40 years over Israel, 7 years in Hebron, 33 in Jerusalem. So Solomon sat on the throne of his father David, and his rule was firmly established. Solomon, whose name means shalom, or peace. What will this peace, what will this shalom look like? And as he begins to reign now, how seriously will Solomon take his father's words? Will he remember? Will he heed this, staying true to the law? And then the second part about bringing gray heads down to the grave in blood, which seems to contradict the first part. Will Solomon honor the instructions? And if so, which ones? Let's begin to answer that. Verse 13. Now, Adonijah, the son of Haggith, went to Bathsheba, Solomon's mother. Bathsheba asked him, "Do you come peacefully?" He answered, "Yes, peacefully." Then he added, "I have something to say to you." "You may say it," she replied. "As you know," he said, "the kingdom was mine. All Israel looked to me as their king." This seems to be quite the exaggeration. But things changed, and the kingdom has gone to my brother, for it has come to him from the Lord. Now, I have one request to make of you. Do not refuse me." "You may make it," she said. So he continued, "Please ask King Solomon, he will not refuse you, to give me Abishag the Shunammite as my wife." "Very well," Bathsheba replied, "I will speak to the king for you." Adonijah, in other words, is saying, "Look, I lost everything. Woe is me." And considering how tough things have been for me, can I just have this one teeny weeny little request? Do you really think Adonijah couldn't find a girl? I mean, think about it. A beautiful girl, if that's what he wanted. He was the son of King David, after all. He had money, land, social status. Text tells us he was a handsome guy. I'm guessing he was charming. It's just like, think of a single version of Mike Spencer. I mean, it just... Yes. Just had it all. Everything going for him, except one thing. He just want this one girl. So he approaches Bathsheba. Do you remember when Absalom took over David's harem, his concubines? That was a power move. That was a claim to the throne. Whoever possessed the royal harem was thought to possess the kingdom. And this couldn't be anything different. You won't convince me that Adonijah's request here was innocent. It was a tremendous gamble on his part. It was just like going for broke, hoping that Solomon was young enough and naive enough to not see what was going on here. Question is, why did Bathsheba fall for this? How could she fall for this? Was she naive? And are we sure she did fall for it? Let me explain. I was reading this week. I've always kind of, this has mystified me. Why did she go along with this? And one person that I read made a suggestion that maybe she knew exactly what was going to happen. Maybe Bathsheba all along, you know, we knew that Adonijah wanted the throne, right? And here he is, he's still alive, and he's lurking out there. And is my son even going to survive now that David is gone? Maybe she understood. Maybe she gave Solomon enough credit to know that he was going to take care of business. And wanting Adonijah out of the way, went along with it for that reason. Not sure. Let's see what happens. Verse 19. When Bathsheba went to King Solomon to speak to him for Adonijah, the king stood up to meet her, bowed down to her, and sat down on his throne. He had a throne brought for the king's mother, and she sat down at his right hand. "I have one small request to make of you," she said. "Do not refuse me." And the king replied, "Make it, my mother. I will not refuse you." Why do people do this? I promise I'll give you whatever you want even before I hear it. You know, that's what happened to John the Baptist, right? With Herod, Matthew 14, that whole thing. Why do people do that? My kids try this on me. "Dad, we have a question. Just say yes, okay?" Like, I'm not stupid. You're going to ask for a horse. It's like, why do kings fall for this? I don't get it. The king replied, "Make it, my mother. I will not refuse you." So she said, "Let Abishag the Shunammite be given in marriage to your brother Adonijah." King Solomon answered his mother, "Why do you request Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? You might as well request the kingdom for him. After all, he is my older brother. Yes, for him and for Abiathar the priest and Joab, son of Zeruiah." Then King Solomon swore by the Lord, "May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if Adonijah does not pay with his life for this request." Just kind of backtracking on his promise here. "And now, as surely as the Lord lives, he who has established me securely on the throne of my father David and has founded a dynasty for me as he promised, Adonijah shall be put to death today." So King Solomon gave orders to Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, and he struck down Adonijah, and he died. Who wants to live in a monarchy? Who wants to live under a king? I mean, just one wrong move. To Abiathar the priest, the king said, "Go back to your fields in Anathoth. You deserve to die, but I will not put you to death now because you carried the ark of the sovereign Lord before my father David and shared all of my father's hardships." So Solomon removed Abiathar from the priesthood of the Lord, fulfilling the word the Lord had spoken at Shiloh about the house of Eli. And this is just another theme to kind of watch for in 1 and 2 Kings, the fulfillment of the word of the Lord. God had promised Eli, this is it, your line is done. And now Abiathar sees that. Verse 28, when the news reached Joab, who had conspired with Adonijah. And I'm not sure. I kind of think this is referring to that initial run at kingship, but I'm not sure. Because it says, "though not with Absalom." He fled to the tent of the Lord and took hold of the horns of the altar. So that initially worked for Adonijah. Joab tries it. Okay. This looks like someone who knows he's guilty, by the way, I think. And I'm guessing he probably had something to do with this request for Abishag. One thing is for sure, he's not overreacting here. Verse 29, King Solomon was told that Joab had fled to the tent of the Lord and was beside the altar. Then Solomon ordered Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, "Go strike him down." So Benaiah entered the tent of the Lord and said to Joab, "The king says, come out." But he answered, "No, I will die here." Benaiah reported this to the king. "This is how Joab answered me." So is Solomon going to honor the sacredness of the altar now? Will he stay true to the law in Exodus 21, which says that a man should not be put to death at the altar? What's he going to do? Let's see, verse 31. Then the king commanded Benaiah, "Do as he says, strike him down and bury him, and so clear me and my father's house of the blood of the innocent, of the guilt of the innocent blood that Joab shed. The Lord will repay him for the blood he shed, because without the knowledge of my father David, he attacked two men and killed them with the sword, both of them, Abner, son of Ner, commander of Israel's army, and Amasa, son of Jether, commander of Judah's army, were better men and more upright than he. May the guilt of their blood rest on the head of Joab and his descendants forever, but on David and his descendants, his house and his throne, may there be the Lord's peace forever." So Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, went and struck down Joab and killed him, and he was buried on his own land in the desert. There's that old saying, whoever lives by the sword, what? Dies by the sword. And how many times has history proven that saying, right? Of course, that's from Jesus, right? Put away your sword, Peter. I've wondered before, who did Jesus have in mind? Like, did he have examples in mind? Who would be a better example of this than Joab? So Solomon basically defies the law here. He executes Joab right there as Joab's clinging to the altar. And I think that defiance of the law is, I mean, it seems like it's like one of his first acts. And it seems to foreshadow Solomon's treatment of God's decrees and commands. It seems to hint as to whether or not Solomon will share his father's desire to be true to the God of Israel and the law of Moses. And in the interest of time, we're going to just kind of skip this part about Shimei. We don't have a lot of time for that. But if you haven't had a chance to read that, read what becomes of him. You'll see that Solomon fulfills the wishes of his father, David. Who wants to live in a monarchy? You do. So do I. We're not going to vote Jesus in. You know that, right? It's not how it works. This isn't like a representative republic where we vote for Jesus and he wins and then he comes and he does a town hall so that he can hear from his constituents and know exactly how to pander to them. That's not how it's going to work. He's king, appointed by the Father. No voting except the Father's vote. One vote. And I want to live in that kingdom. And I think that everything we read in 1st and 2nd Kings points to that kingdom. The good stuff and the bad. I think all of it does. It points to the coming kingdom. And when we read about a good king, that should intensify our longing to see Jesus. And when we read about a bad king, that should intensify our longing to see the one who is perfect. You know, sometimes we can learn from the bad examples just as well as we can learn from the good ones. You take a son who maybe grows up in a home with an alcoholic father and he sees his dad come home, beats his wife, can't hold down a job. For some sons, what that will do is it will actually lead them into the exact same sin. But do you know that for some of them, it drives them a million miles away from that? Do you know that? We can learn from the good as well as from the bad, depending on where our hearts are. Sometimes seeing the devastation of evil just gives us a greater longing, a greater intense desire for what is right, what is true, and what is beautiful. That's coming. In fact, it's here. Do you know that you live in this kingdom right now? Jesus isn't waiting to be a king. Do you know he's a king now? And you live under his kingship. So do I. We don't see him face to face, but that doesn't mean we can't be loyal to him. I want to live in a monarchy. I want to live under a king. It just matters who the king is. I don't want to live under a monarchy that is exactly like David, okay? Where you get this pledge, you will not die, and for whatever reason, the pledge is revoked. A king whose pardon is insincere or temporary. I don't want to live under a monarchy like Solomon. Solomon, wise, but used his wisdom for self-interest to perpetuate his power. It's not the kind of monarchy I want to live under. I want to live under a monarchy ruled by a king who is perfectly wise, perfectly just, perfectly loving, and I do. And so do you. And we can look to this king. We don't see him yet, but we will. And the ugliness of human sin cannot stop God's plan. Nothing that happens in 1st and 2nd Kings can thwart God's plan. The Messiah is coming, for sure. And it's just as true for us to say that the Messiah is coming back, for sure. And though we don't see him now, we will. It's a sure thing. You will see him with your eyes. Are you longing for that day? May we never lose hope.